Hello and welcome to Business Beat on 90.5 WICN. My name is David Ginsberg.
And Giselle Rivera-Flores.
I was on mute. Giselle, this is easily the most prominent guest that we've had in the history of our time together in Business Beat. I am honored to welcome Aaron Brockovich to Business Beat on WICN. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thank you. Sorry, I had to turn my phone off.
Me on. We've had a little bit of a technical difficulty today, but we're here. And the reason that you're joining us today, and we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us, is that you are coming to our fair corner of the world on Sunday, April 7th, as part of the Bull Run Speaker Series. It is a benefit for Animal and Environmental Fund of the Community Foundation of North Central Massachusetts. It is a brunch event, so doors open at 10 o'clock. You are speaking at noon, and we're going to talk about why you're speaking in a moment. You're speaking in part about protecting our water and, more importantly, the local issues. But the reason I want to make mention of the Bull Run first is that do buy a ticket for both a brunch and a speaker series. Support a local venue that has been in operation for a couple of hundred years. Bull Run is a phenomenal place. It's been there since 1740 in Shirley, half an hour from Worcester. And the first ever speaker at the Bull Run Speaker Series was a local water activist named Marion Stoddart. And she's going to be a special guest on Sunday, April 7th at the Bull Run. You can get tickets at bullrunrestaurant.com/Aaron Brockovich. Now then, we can talk to our main event here, and we'll plug the show again in a little bit. You're here to help support this, and your latest book, and I want to talk about this because we were talking about the environmental issues as we were working out our Zoom issues in advance of the show today. You have a new book out called Superman's Not Coming, Our National Water Crisis and What We the People Can Do About It, and it takes the fight against water pollution to the big boys by empowering everyday citizens to take action. But how did we get in this crisis, and what are we going to do?
Oh my gosh, hard questions out the gate. I've learned when I talk about water, so everybody knows that water is, it's never a soundbite. It's always a story, and it's generally a long story. How we got here, I've got to tell you, I have been doing this for 30 years, working specifically in environmental water issues through five different administrations. So, I get frustrated on these environmental issues, water issues, that it's a right or left thing. No, it's not. It's an everybody thing. And what we've done, both in a corporate model, and I've seen it happening within government, we kicked the can down the line. It's going to be the next administration's problem. It'll be the next CEO's problem. Instead of dealing with the issue, infrastructure failures or other problems on the upfront, we like to kick the can down the line. And those back winds have now caught us, and we're in a big mess. We're really pushed up against a wall. So there's a lot of water issues throughout the country. I've often shared with people who don't always understand climate change to give them a visual that it will be a water issue. We're going to either have too much water, too little water, or none at all. And I think we're all starting to observe those changes from, migratory pathways happening from arid climates. We're losing aquifers. We're having mass flooding. This will create more water issues on top of the polluted water issues that we continue to have. So I wrote Superman's Not Coming, having 30 years in the field and being in multiple communities in multiple states, is we have to be a part of it. I don't know if we got comfortable. I don't know if we got complacent. I don't know if we bought a bunch of BS, if you will, that agencies or somebody would save us, fix it, report it, oversee it, come in and save the day. When actually what's happening is everyday people, like in Hinckley, California, way back in the day that started the movie Aaron Brockovich, were on well water, that started to notice change of water color. Started to notice changes in their children, rashes, started noticing farm animals getting sick, babies being born with birth defects. It actually starts in your own backyard, and it starts with you being able to recognize something's wrong, asking if something's wrong, daring to ask if something's wrong, making a phone call, because more often than not, we're the ones that will be the game changer and not some big oversight. It actually begins with you to your community within your own backyard. And we do talk about in the book, Aaron Brockovich, I'm looking at Aaron Brockovich, Superman's Not Coming, about these communities, and it can get very laborious and very hard in the middle of the book, talking about agency failures, talking about antiquated infrastructures, talking about old business models that may have done us well-intended at the pre-height of an industrial revolution. But here we are post-industrial revolution, yet we've changed out no ideas, no policies, no infrastructures, no upgrades, system failure, and we're feeling ginormous effects now from pollution and failing municipalities throughout the entire country. That's a nutshell. Do you want me to stop there? I'll take a breath and you can be,
sure.
You can ask me maybe another question. You can ask me anything you want, but it's not a short
I think you just let her finish, David.
I didn't say anything. No, it's, you said a mouthful, and I'm curious because we're seeing repeated crises. So the one in Hinckley, California, that you uncovered that began this career as an activist and a fighter, you know, against the entrenched interests. We've seen it as recently as a few years ago with Flint, Michigan, and the water supply there, and then the denial that there was a problem in the first place before the media attention got so severe that they had to take some kind of action. But it's very often, and we see this and we talk about this on the show a lot, it's poor communities that are the ones suffering the most, that have the least wherewithal to fight back, or the fewest resources to fight back with, which compounds the problem. And I'm curious, in the 30 years you've been doing this, 30 years ago, we didn't have pervasive internet and social media, and the propaganda and disinformation that flows through that are often covers, you know, we've seen this with oil and gas companies that create so-called nonprofit think tanks as front organizations to create climate denialism because they want to be able to keep drilling for gas and shale and fracking and so forth unimpeded and not have to pay any consequence for the damage they do environmentally in those communities that they're working in. As an activist, and all of that, and then political change is on top of that, where corporate lobbyist money, dark money, has increased exponentially since the 2012 decision, Citizens United decision. So now there's a flood of money that's protecting the polluters, that's protecting the system as it currently stands. To your earlier point, you've been doing this through five administrations, and we're still having the same conversations and the same battles through those five administrations. With all those changes in the battle that you face, it's very much a Sisyphean battle to get that rock up the hill. How do you adapt to that fight so that you can harness those tools in a way that gets the word out and gets the masses not only angry, but taking action to do something to protect their communities and their kids?
Well, that, you know, that's a really good question. And so to go all the way back to the beginning, you know, 30 years ago that they didn't know. Yes, they did know. You know, I was born and raised in the Midwest, and my father, I'm from a family of engineers. My dad actually built and ran the pipelines for Texaco. So at a very, 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 very young age, I was learning about the environment through him, water issues through him, what we needed to protect, what the problems could be. He promised me in my lifetime water would be a commodity. He's going to be right. But when I started working in Hinckley, I would be calling him about what was going on. So PG&E is pushing and pulling natural gas from kind of around El Paso, Texas, that comes through Arizona, that gets pushed up to Hinckley, then Hinckley pushes it up to Kettleman, Kettleman pushes it up to the Oregon border. And at each location, they go through a gas compressor plant. And it works very much like the piston engine of your car. And, you know, these units get overheated very quickly. So they have to run water through the system, and they don't want it to rust or corrode, so they add a chemical, hexavalent chromium. To your point that they didn't know, out the gate, one of the first calls when I called my dad and I'd send him information, he goes, are you sure this is right, Aaron? Because this is a very antiquated system. It should be fan cooled. He knew it then. Yep. So did PG&E. But we get down to that almighty buck. You know, it makes me think, are you familiar with the Ford Pinto theory way back in the day?
Yes, I'm old.
Where they had the gas tank that was built at the back, and so when the car got rear-ended, it would explode?
Yep.
Well, this is, from my theory and perspective, as I've seen it for 30 years, that kind of stuck with corporations, and frankly, I think it's stuck within agencies as well. It's cheaper to pay the lawsuit than it is to deal with the problem. Okay, that's not working out well for anybody.
Yep.
So they did know. And I think that we are in a moment, you know, I could take us down such a miserable, depressed, dark outcome, if you want me to really start honing in on the severity of the water crisis that we are all getting ready to face. But I want to say, having said that, in this moment, I actually have more hope than I've had in a very long time. And here's why. Because we, the people, are waking up. Mothers are on the move. They're making it their job to find out. They're asking questions. They're choosing to get involved. And that will be the pivotal change for us. It's been decades of lack of oversight, lack of enforcement. We need new policies. We have to have a change of a corporate mindset. I'm happy to see ESG, these new rules getting yep. involved. And we're going to have a change at the top where we can't run the line just down to the point. We're just going to run ourselves completely into the ground. We're on the cusp of doing that now. But the hope and the change is here. And I think it is us. All of us in this country are seeing we're going through a lot, but yet we are responding. We're showing up. We may not always like what somebody else has to say, but it will take us to get involved. And that's what keeps me hopeful. My communities, watching them rise up, watching them have the courage, watching them believing that they can. And I want to say something about that here that is extraordinarily important that I've learned through my entire life. There's always going to be somebody else that wants to define who you are. I learned that early as a dyslexic. I learned I don't like to be in a box. And I learned that I could find ways to get out of what wasn't a box necessarily of somebody else's limitations on me, but limitations that I put on myself. So when I first began in Hinckley, I was told by everybody, oh, your skirt's too short. Why are you wearing those shoes? You've got a foul mouth. You're not a doctor. You're not a lawyer. You're not a scientist. You're not a politician. You're a single mom. What do you have to say? And I was gobsmacked because I'm like, there it is. You want to define me because of your perception of something? Well, let me tell you, I didn't have to be any of that to be a human. And to tell you what I see is wrong. Two-headed frogs and green water is not normal. And I stood with what I saw. I believed in what I saw. And then every other community member who took the same position, we became a strong force. I see that happening in communities across this country. So this is going to be about what I see, that we are learning about ourselves, our strength, our courage, our hearts, our minds, and putting it back to work. And that will be the change that's going to have to happen, where we push for these changes legislatively, through policies, through election cycles, through administrations, to local government, all the way down to your own city council. We are the game changer, and we, the people, have got to start showing up. And I'm telling you, we will be able to help navigate through these waters to a better side. But that's not going to happen if we stay silent.
I want to say, you mentioned something really incredibly important to me, and I think to everyone listening in, which is these processes are cheaper and cost effective for the company. However, what's not cost effective is the burden that it places on the country, on our people, right? So annually, we lose about $9 billion in things like labor, production, household earnings, healthcare costs, because of all the associations and negative associations with our water crisis. And so most people see it for in small pockets, right? We talk about these conversations in little silos. Oh, it's cost effective for the company. Oh, it's just in this area. Not realizing the major factor that it plays in getting people to work, in making sure that healthcare is a part, making sure that our ERs are not filled with individuals that are sick, which then plays into our healthcare system, our insurance system, that is also a flawed system. So nothing about this can fully function if we don't also look at the other factors that play into it to ensure that we are looking at it in a very broad conversation to say, this is bigger than this small town. This is replicated everywhere. This is the reoccurring data supporting. This is surveyed and this has been proven that we need to take a very important step in our infrastructure to ensure that we don't continue to not only take on the burden as a country financially, but to also alleviate our communities of this burden with health and wellness.
Absolutely. And it begins, you know, with that community. And we're already there into a huge health crisis and an environmental crisis and all kinds of disasters, as you shared. And if we're going to talk about money, I think we're going way beyond $9 billion. By the time we deal with all of this, we're going to be pushing into the trillions. I really speculate that as we all watch our infrastructures fail, like our grid systems, like roads, like bridges, like the railroads, like companies that won't invest in themselves on the upfront. And this is where you could have policies, and companies have a big room to play here, to step up to the plate and make a change that makes a difference for the environment, for its workers, for the community, for public health and welfare, for the municipal water systems across the country. So what you said is absolutely true. And I've watched where those failures are. If we want to talk about PG&E for a moment, a company that, you know, worth 100 plus billion. When we first got involved in Hinckley and settled that case for $333 million, people don't realize they're on a 100-year corporate cleanup. 100-year.
Wow.
So you can add another $100 million onto that, not to mention defense costs. So that first case originally settled for probably closer to $1 billion. Then they did it again in Kettleman further up the line. And then we dealt with their infrastructure issues on the San Bruno explosion all the way to the current fires in Northern California. Their idea of kicking the can down the line, and it's cheaper to face a $333 million lawsuit. Oh, maybe you could have thought that then, but you better not think that now, because these cases are settling at $25 billion, $28 billion, $38 billion. If you would flip your model and do right on the upfront, you not only would save a lot of money in litigation, you would save lives. You would save people from getting disease. You would save property. You would have a healthier workforce. You would have a more trusting community. You're still going to make a profit, but you will yield much more greater rewards by a clean environment, clean land, clean water. And I don't know if they're on the cusp of maybe wanting, and again, I think ESG is going to help guide them to that place, but you're spot on with what you said. And it's an overall arching deal. And people don't always understand these water issues, these climate issues, the chemicals that are destroying aquifers, the land, the food chain, and in turn is destroying us. And to continue on this path is only a path of actually destroying us. And I don't know why we would continue to do that. We're going to have to change, and people resisted at first, but we're going to have to look into our future and address, oh my gosh, you know, I'm looking at this bull right now, the Bull Run series, makes me think of the buffalo. I'm from Kansas, and I'm going to tell you a quick little story because this is where we need to be. The buffalo instinctually knows to turn into the storm, not to turn away from it. Turn into it, because it can move through those headwinds faster, and it instinctually knows when it turns its back, when it kicks a can down the line, the worst of that storm, the backwinds, will catch it. That's exactly where we are and exactly where we need to be right now. No more woulda, coulda, shoulda, or blame game. We need to turn into this storm, because we can cut through it. And together, and I mean this, with people, with cooperations from corporations, with cooperation between parties and agencies, we can turn this around before it really is too late.
We are speaking with Erin Brockovich. Just a reminder that Erin Brockovich will be at the Bull Run in Shirley on Sunday, April 7th, as part of their speaker series. Brunch begins at 10. The speaker series begins at noon. BullRunRestaurant.com for more. One of the things I wanted to ask you about within this is,
am I talking too long or talking too fast?
No, I could have you on all day. This is fantastic. But I want to condense it because we have 8 minutes left in the Zoom, and I want to make sure we get it all in. A couple of quick things. And one is, to your point, have we reached a tipping point where there's an awareness level of climate change that it's no longer deniable? We see the intensity of storms increasing. We see worse annual fire seasons in California in particular. We see worse hurricanes destroying infrastructure across the south of the United States and across the world, for that matter. We see this everywhere. We see the hottest global temperatures. Every month seems to set a new record in global temperatures across the world. Are we reaching a critical mass of awareness that people are just, you can't close your eyes to what's right in front of you anymore, and that we can't kick the can down the road any longer? And by the way, pick the can up and recycle it.
We're getting there. Do I think we're fully there? Not yet. Who I think's really in tune to this are these next generations coming up. And I think that they're going to push for a lot of changes. And I do a lot of speaking, and I always encourage them. Because oftentimes, especially, you know, younger girls I've seen, they don't think they could be in the sciences or policies or things like that. Oh, hell yes, you can. And that's where I think they're going to start turning, and we could change the tide there. We are on our way, as we kind of talked before we got on. People are visual. I'm very visual. And, you know, seeing is believing. And so now that the storm is here and we're seeing more of them, we're starting to see that pattern. It's helping us to realize, look, you can call climate change whatever you want. Really, you can. The change is here. I talk about the power of observation all the time. And we can't deny that. So I think that's tipping us in a much better direction, where collectively all of us are going, okay, yeah, there's a problem here. So I have some hope there. And I am seeing those changes, as I think we all are. And it's becoming a bigger and bigger conversation. And I'm not going to sit here and say a little too late, better now than never, because I don't think we have a whole lot of time. But what I do talk about, and I think it's super important, is I call it my PIRP, planning, implementation. You have your plan and begin to implement it. But where I think we get into trouble is the R, where we're not realistic about the goals. I think it's great that we've got an idea to build back a better America. But we've got to really start looking at and having this conversation about our infrastructures. So I'm glad to see that we're putting in place replacements of all the lead pipes. But to be realistic about it, we've got to be honest with people about the timeline, the goal, and how long that's going to take. We can't step out tomorrow and say, oh, yay, we've got the funding and we're going to have lead-free water for the United States of America tomorrow. Not true. It's going to take a decade for full completion. So what I want to see is start to put into play is, what's your preparedness plan? What's your plan B? Are you just going to let people for the next 10 years continue to drink water that's poisoned with lead? Or what do you do in the interim until you reach that goal? You know, I'm the parent that does not like to go to Disneyland with my grandparents without a plan B. And I'm serious. I have to think about that now. What if there's a mass earthquake? What do I do in an emergency? Lord forbid, what if there was a mass shooting? Now, we can see and know these things are coming. So I think it's critical, not only about our planning, but being realistic about our goals of implementation, how long it's going to take. Can the system handle it? Until we reach that goal, by gosh, there's things that we can begin to do to be prepared. So when it does hit, we're prepared.
Agreed.
It's critical.
I was just saying, yes, I'm like, not only is this important and critical and significant in our everyday conversation, but just hearing you speak, Aaron, I'm like, you know, fangirling here because, you know, obviously I'm biased, but it's just empowering. And you're right, we need to encourage women and young girls to ensure that they are in spaces that they're supposed to be in, and they continue to do the work that feels right to them and gives them a sense of purpose. And for many of us that is in the sciences, and somehow throughout the narrative of our society, we have been told that we're not supposed to be there. And I think that you are proving otherwise. And so I'm just thrilled. I'm just sitting here listening. So you are not speaking a lot. You can speak for hours and I will be completely all ears.
I guess like my kids, Mom, please stop. My ears are burning.
Listen, if you're able to put Giselle to a place where she's just going to sit back and listen, you've done an amazing job so far. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I'm very passionate about this.
But that's important. 100%. I mean, it's passion is, in many cases, is what drives us. And, you know, as an activist, I'm curious, Aaron, in that 30 years of doing this, how do you stay in the fight? How do you keep yourself focused on the goal and not get so exasperated that you go, oh, enough already, or you get burned out from the constant battle against these entrenched powers? How do you motivate yourself to do this day in and day out to this after so many decades of doing so?
You know, that's a great question. And I do talk about that. You know what? I allow myself to be exhausted. I allow myself to feel vulnerable. I allow myself to throw myself on the couch and stomp my feet and cry in a pillow for 2 hours. You know, we don't allow ourselves to be frustrated or to be fearful or to feel vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it's when I go in those places that I realize, okay, I've recognized that, and it's okay to feel vulnerable. It's okay to be tired. It's okay to defeat it. But I want to ask myself, and I ask other people to do the same. Why am I doing this anyway? Why am I in this fight? Why am I going through this frustration? And it dawns on me that my motivator is driven, honestly, by love. I mean that. You know, I love this planet. You know, I grew up in Kansas. I love just watching the wheat fields sway in unison in the wind. I love the fact of clean, fresh water. I love the sound of it. I love the smell of fresh rain. I love the land. It just kind of oozes out of me. And I think that we all do, but we take it for granted. And what drives me to want to keep this passion going, especially now as a grandmother, and I'm in my legacy phase, is I love the idea that we leave them a future that's still green and that kind of freedom and the earth, it's spectacular, it's wonderful. And we've got to stop pushing against it and start working with it. So my why is I allow myself to be imperfect.
All right, we had a momentary interruption, but we are speaking with Aaron Brockovich here on Business Beat on 90.5 WICN. Again, a reminder before we resume our conversation that Aaron is going to be at the Bull Run in Shirley on Sunday, April 7th for their speaker series. It is a benefit for the Animal and Environmental Fund of the Community Foundation of North Central Massachusetts. Brunch begins at 10. The speaker series begins at noon. And again, brunch is not included. You need to buy the brunch ticket as well as the speaker series ticket. And we encourage you to do so. The Bull Run is a small family-owned endeavor. So please do support them. And the brunch is going to be delicious, of course. We were talking before we had a little interruption about your passion for the world itself and from growing up in Kansas and the wheat fields blowing and wanting clean water and wanting a healthy environment and healthy air for us. And that's the fuel that still drives your passion going forward. So we were talking about how do you keep that fight? Because it's one thing to be motivated by spite, which, you know, can be very motivating for short periods of time, trust me. But in the long run, it's not only passion. You have to be, it's a commitment to your core values throughout the course of your life, if that's an accurate assessment.
It's true. And, you know, I talk a lot, you know, it's a long game.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can be a little more strategic than people might know, but that is something that I've learned, especially in my career over 30 years, where I can keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And if you're never taking a break, or if you don't understand why you're doing it, or you're losing your passion, it never turns out well. So what I've learned over 30 years is to recognize myself when I'm exhausted, when I'm losing my passion, when I'm so frustrated or angry that I'm not presenting well, where, you know, it can just fall on a deaf ear. And I see a lot of people involved in the environment that take the activism too far and see that's a bad message, and then people don't listen anymore.
Yeah.
So what I've learned to do is turn inward. I do a lot of analogies to the environment because we are the environment. I don't know why we think we're disconnected from it. And like I shared with you about the buffalo.
Yep.
When I turn inward, look, even in nature, in order for a caterpillar to morph into a butterfly, it has to dissect itself first. And oftentimes we don't want to look at ourselves because we're afraid of our flaws, our vulnerability, where we made our mistakes. And here's what I've learned is actually forgiving of myself. I'm imperfect. I don't know anyone who's perfect. I'm exhausted. I'm going to have to say no for a day. I'm upset. I'm going to throw myself on the couch. I'm going to have a good cry. I'll allow myself the tantrum and own that I'm vulnerable, that I'm tired, and give myself that time out to rethink about why am I doing this? What would be my next move? I'm missing the kids too much. How can I solve that? So kind of have a little strategic plan myself and then come back out again the next day or within 3 days, refresh, rebooted, and to go after it again. But I have to remind myself, really, why am I doing this? I ask myself this all the time when I was doing Hinckley. Listen, I was making $1,600 a month.
Oof.
I had three kids. I was not surviving that well.
Yeah.
And I couldn't see my kids. And it dawned on me, why am I doing this? Why would I just not quit? You know, F it, right, man. I'm out of here. I need to go be with my kids. I got to have a better paying job. But what I realized is why I was doing it. Because I love the environment. I loved the people I was meeting. I had empathy. I had compassion. And I loved my children. And I was a parent that got no child support. So to even give up what I was earning, and mind you, I wasn't seeing them, I loved the idea that I could feed my kids.
Yeah.
I loved the idea that I could work towards. And the law firm always helped me out with making sure I had rent. And it dawned on me that I was doing it from love. And you know, I sit back and watch of late the hate that exists today.
Yeah.
And where we go nowhere. And so I allow myself to be vulnerable. I allow myself to embrace that and to rest and to regroup, rethink, and reboot. You know, I've talked about this before in other keynotes, and I think of it like the computer. You know, when too much data comes in at once, the blue dot just goes around and around and
yes,
around. And if it can't refresh, boom, you're down.
Yep.
We have to do the same for ourselves.
We do.
And so that's a moment where you can reconnect to your environment. And when you do, you find yourself.
You do. And it's a great point. What I was going to ask you is, you know, I think of the Bob Dylan song, I Contain Multitudes, which is true, because we all do. There's so many different editions of ourselves. You know, I'm different with my mom than I am with my girlfriend, than I am with my dog, than I am with my neighbors and friends. We all contain multitudes and within myself. And to what you were saying is some of that sort of self-knowledge and the ability to say, okay, I'm going to have a good cry. I'm going to lay on the couch. I'm going to watch dumb TV for half an hour and zone out or whatever it might be, whatever that thing is. Is that partly due to just life experience and knowing what it takes? You know who you are internally and the ability to just say, this is what's best for me right now, and it's going to allow me to do what I want to do next in a couple of hours or tomorrow, whatever that cadence is going to be.
Absolutely. It is very much learned. So if I go back to my childhood as a dyslexic, it took me steps of stick-to-itiveness, getting out of the box, connecting to my environment, all the way up into being an early mom to learn that. And then from Hinckley to today, I started Hinckley in about 92, 93. You do the math. It's been, 24 years since the film came out. I've been doing my job 30 years or longer. And it's just been really of late in the past few years that I've been able to look back and go, where I missed something. Because I can tell you at 63 now, versus 32, I would have pushed through that. I now, you know, I have a gift of wisdom and something learned, and I can see so many of us, and I see so many moms in communities that are afraid to step up and step out, not only because somebody thinks that they can't, but they believe themselves they can't. Yep. They believe that maybe they shouldn't. And that's where we have to turn inward. And when we trust our instincts, believe what we see, trust in what we're feeling, and own it and stand with ourselves and our decisions to go, okay, I'm imperfect. I'm tired. I know I'm just going to disappoint you, but I got to take a step out. That's when you find your strength. That's when you find your courage. That's where you find self-forgiveness. And when you have that moment to rethink, re-strategize, reboot, guess what? You come out swinging the next time.
Without a doubt. I couldn't have said that any better. In a parallel, I think it's important that the title of the book, the most recent book at least, Superman's Not Coming, Our National Water Crisis and What We the People Can Do About It. Superman's Not Coming, it's, you know, I think we all, and I'm certainly have been guilty of this in my life, where we sort of wait for someone to come along and save us from whatever situation that we find ourselves in. We wait for someone to swoop in and fix it for us. And as an example, without going too far into it, my mom is 82. She's not in great shape. She's going through hell. What my stepfamily is, they're essentially torturing her over money, and it's horrifying. And she's always had this notion of someone's going to come in and save the day. And I'm certainly doing all I can do, but I'm one person, and I'm fighting, you know, a very difficult battle. And I've had to kind of sit down and explain as best I can that although I'm doing everything that I can possibly do to help and try and make the situation bearable and get us through this, I can't just snap my fingers and make it all better. And in her life, my mom's a very tough, very smart woman, and I love her dearly. But she's always had the syndrome of the world's out to get me. Someone's got to come in and snap their fingers and fix this for me. It's not going to happen. You can't sit around waiting for magical thinking to solve your problems. You've got to be the one to take action. You've got to be your own Superman. You've got to be the only one or superwoman to put on you know, the uniform and go out and fight the fight to the best of your ability, and then take a pause to reboot yourself when you get depleted.
You know, you need to. And, you know, listen, again, it's learned that Superman's not coming. I'm certainly not Superwoman. What I want to try to teach and share with people is you have to look no further than the person in the mirror.
Yeah.
Find that strength and the courage. And it takes a little bit of work, you know, if you self-doubt and you don't believe. And I think we all know the steps that we would need to take to get out of that perception. It goes back to, is your glass half empty or is it half full? And so I want to impart to others, Superman isn't coming. And you know what? When you first hear that, it can kind of make you mad. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, it reminds me of The Wizard of Oz. Honestly, you know, not the film, but the book and why it was written. But, you know, Dorothy and her cast of characters, you know, what were they told to do? Go follow the yellow brick road. Follow the path of money. Go find the wizard because he's going to fix it for you. But what they learned when they got there is there was no wizard. But right. That they themselves had a heart, had a brain, and had a courage all along to find their way back. And that's true of us. But along the journey, we've all gotten comfortable, complacent, misled, uncertain, a different perception of who we really are. And I think there's a great moment here. Maybe we're all seeing there is no wizard. It's time to reinvigorate and find ourselves. But it's disappointing. Look, I've learned Prince Charming isn't coming either. 3 times. And I'm telling you, I've been disappointed and plenty mad, but you get over it. And it feels really good when you own your own stuff. It's empowering. And it's taken time to learn that. So some of these things are learned over time.
It's a brilliant way to state it, Erin. I couldn't agree with you more. It's, you know, it's, and some of it is the wisdom that we gain is just, there's no substitute for life experience. And just you fall down, you pick yourself back up and you do the best you can to keep on going. It's not easy. You're going to stumble along the way for sure, but you keep on going and finding ways that work for you. I don't want to hold you too much longer, but I do want to just come back to something you were talking about before earlier in our conversation, and that you said you're in your legacy phase now. And I think that's a brilliant phase, a brilliant phrase for this stage of your life. And you're still working, still active, and still living life to the fullest. What does that legacy mean to you for 50 years from now?
The grandchildren, the future of these next generations, and frankly, the planet. And so it'd be 11 years now. I'm very honest. I have no problem ever telling anyone I effed up. I made a mistake. I misspoke. I'm sorry, because I'm good at owning my own stuff. I like to own my own stuff. Nobody else needs to do that for me. I was tired. I was fed up. I was frustrated with the side of the law. You know, I felt defeated sometimes in other communities because they couldn't go on, or we didn't win. We lost a policy challenge. It could be a plethora of things. I thought, I'm done. And 11 years ago, my first granddaughter, my first grandbaby was born. And I happened to be in the room, and she came fast. And I was at the one on the receiving end with the doctor to catch her. And I am telling you, the second she was in my arms, I became the Lion King. It was kumbaya. I'm like, yes. And I'm like, this is it. This is the fight. It's for her, for my other grandchildren, the next generations, the planet. What would be so important to me to leave a legacy is to impart and embolden them that fighting for this land, your health, your water, your family, there's nothing greater, there's nothing more valuable, and there's nothing more important. So my first grandchildren truly became a kumbaya moment for me. That's my legacy.
That's phenomenal. I hope that for all the WSM listeners that are tuned into Business Beat today, that you'll be inspired and motivated to go to the Bull Run on April 7th, Sunday. Get the early doors and brunch begin at 10. Aaron will be speaking at noon. There is a special guest. I want to make mention of this one more time, that Marion Stoddart, who is the first ever speaker in the series and a local clean water activist who's done an awful lot. She was the founder, the first president of the Nashua River Watershed Association, and worked tirelessly, as you do, for clean water and clean waterways, and resulted in the first anti-water pollution bill enacted by any state in the U.S., which was the 1965 Massachusetts Clean Water Act. And despite the fact that we are still...
Amazing.
It is. And despite the reputation of Massachusetts being a progressive state, which of course it is, we are, you know, compared to some other parts of the country, we certainly are.
Yes.
But we still have contaminated water here too. We still have, as most of the country is dealing with the PFAS, the PFAS, the forever chemicals that are in our water supply, and aging infrastructure that hasn't been replaced yet. We have lead pipes that are, you know, poisoning children. We have so much further yet to go, and it's incumbent upon all of us to take some action concrete, not just posting something on Facebook or, you know, talking about it on the radio, but actually taking concrete steps to lobby your local legislators, to fight for bills that are going to improve the infrastructure and protect the kids, the next generation of kids and the kids after that, so that they don't end up living in either there's too much water that's not drinkable, or there's not enough water, or no water left at all.
Or we've contaminated the food chain. Now we're really screwed.
Yeah. Which,
and you know, for, and look at her, I can't wait to meet her. It will be an honor. And is it a celebration too? Is she turning 90?
I think
Did
so.
I understand that
Something
correctly?
Like that. Yeah.
So, look at the span with her, to me, and the span that I've talked about. It's time. It's time to stop. It's time to pivot and turn into that storm. So she is a true trailblazer, and I have goosebumps getting to meet her. It'll be an honor, and I'm proud of her. She's set a trail for many of us to follow and stuck with it for so very long. She is the true hero of everything that we talk about.
Without a doubt, it's, you know, you blaze a trail and you hope that other people will follow in your footsteps and continue the fight as long as we need to. My last question to let you go is, my dog Pearl is under the console here in the studio with me, and her breath is an environmental disaster in its own right. Is there any way that you can do anything to help that?
Yeah, I got two myself. That's why I spun around. They were in the room. They left. I smelled their breath first.
She's breathing up. You know, I love her dearly, but my God, it's
some breath fresheners. You can put waters, you know, a good dental cleaning or good maintenance of dental cleaning. I have failed that a little with my furry love muffins. I love animals.
Me too.
Some good chew sticks, maybe knock some of the tartar off. Yeah, I feel you.
Aaron Brockovich, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to get
but
to speak with you.
The love is so great. I just feel it.
Oh, I can't thank you enough.
It was great to speak with you.
Thank you. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with us. We're so excited you're coming to Massachusetts. And if you're ever out this way, we'd love to have you in. The invitation is open anytime. This has been Business Beat.
Thank you so much. I'm no stranger to the area.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to seeing you. I'm hoping
to
be there.
I'm no stranger. I'm looking forward to coming back.
Right on. Aaron Brock.
I hope so too.
Thank you so much for joining us.
All right.
Giselle has signed off, but we thank you for listening to Business Beat. This is 90.5 WICN.